may have been a poor investment. When I went to work at the computer lab at MIT almost 40 years ago, it was a fascinating experience. It was a little bit like going into a religious order. It was a military project. No one knew about it on the campus. I really wanted to work on the numerically controlled milling machine computers. I didn't even know about them. They ran out of money for those just those few days when I was looking for a job, and I accepted one at the computer lab. The environment was strange because the job was strange. Making a 10,000-tube computer when the design life of a vacuum tube was 500 hours took a different approach to things. The technology was used 10th microsecond pulses, which is very fast for those days. And the only time people had done anything close to that was in radio frequencies. And shipping pulses around was still a strange idea. So all the technology was new. And a number of ideas that came out of that laboratory were the basis for digital. One of them was that that environment, which had almost the feeling of religious order, was that passion for reliability and discipline. Some of the things may not have been necessary, but the overwhelming desire for reliability, because the job was impossible, and the discipline that went with it. And yet, beside that was the feeling of freedom, free communications, risk-taking, experiment on things you wanted to experiment with, talk to anybody, complain about anything, and intellectual encouragement and challenge. And tying those two ideas together was one of the bases for digital. Freedom, try things, experiment, and yet extreme discipline. One of the other ideas, probably a very significant idea, was the idea of interactive computing. There's only two or three machines being built at a time, maybe four or five. All of them were 6 months for completion, always 6 months before they're complete. But this was the only one that was interactive. The generosity of MIT, the openness, was something we've always tried to capture and sometimes have failed at. They would allow certain students to come in this military project and use the computer at night. It was interactive with the cathode ray tube. They were so generous, they either purposely or didn't know it, allowed them to change the read-only memory. It was soldering diodes, until one day they put the diode back in the wrong place for the morning. Bob Everett played a key part in this. I have some parts from earlier generations of Whirlwind. It was supposed to be a serial machine, and an analog machine, then a serial machine, then a parallel machine. Had to be fast. And I think Bob was the one who, as far as I can tell, he would never say so himself, did the logic design. It was an approach to making computers which, for many years afterward, was strange. We got involved with IBM. Very involved is an understatement. We were deeply involved in IBM. As a result of that, there were two groups at IBM, the traditional computer approach and the Whirlwind approach. With their help, and I like to think with digital's missionary effect, we changed the whole world to the MIT approach, which I think was Bob Everett's approach. What he didn't do with Boolean algebra, maybe he'll tell us. My immediate boss was Norm Taylor, who, joining us today, his son works for us in California, and he was my immediate boss for many years. When I walked in the door, you know, as a young kid, came out of the Navy, where I was absolutely fascinated with a radar with 150 tubes, and here was this thing with 10,000. And I found the smartest guy in the whole place, and sat down beside him every chance I had to learn. And that was Dick Best. Dick Best would spend time drawing circuits so that they're easy to understand by how you drew them. Something that's influenced digital ever since then, trying to make things easy to understand. The cathode ray tube we had, there was no amplifiers. We didn't have amplifiers and cathode ray tubes for years. You went directly into the plate. I learned from Dick how you could measure within a small fraction of a volt something with no amplifier. The fascination of those times was will always be romantic. And everybody played a key part. But in my mind, Bob Everett was associate director. Jay Forrester was the director. Jay was a very bashful but yet flamboyant leader and full of ideas. Bob was the careful, he was the brains behind the outfit, always sober, always right, and did much of the design. Made a wonderful team, and nobody could compete with us. With that team going after them, boy, we never lost. And it's a great privilege now to introduce Bob, who for several years has been our director. He only made one mistake in life that I know of. We invited him to be our chief financial officer at one time, and he turned us down. He ended up heading MITRE, which the country needed badly, but we never quite forgave him for that. Bob?
Well, thank you, Ken, for that flattering introduction. I've heard you say that before, and I'm really worried about the possibility I'll begin to believe what you say after a while. But anyway, I appreciate it. I think Jay and I were a good team. It was a great time. In fact, it wasn't just Jay and me, it was all of us. And I think it was that feeling of a team, this common, open, everybody could talk about everything, problems were everybody's problem. I think that was an extremely important part of it. As a social organization, I think it's something that you can't beat. I sometimes wonder if it's partly I was younger then, but it was a wonderful time. Speaking of being older, I've gotten a little bit used to talking about history, but to find that I'm billed as talking about prehistory, it's going back a long way. Anyway, I'm as Ken said, he and I started at MIT. I'm older than he is. I got there first. I got there in 1942 to go to graduate school. Went to work in the Servo Mechanisms Laboratory. Went to work for Jay. And we spent the next couple of years building a stabilized radar mount for ships. Very different from building a computer, but a very chastening experience for an engineer. We finally got it into production at Westinghouse Airbrake. The production was ramping up. I think that's a good digital term that I've learned recently. And we had to do something else. And we got connected to the Special Devices Center of the Office of Naval Research. I guess it wasn't the Office of Naval Research at the time. This was during the war. The Special Devices Center was run by a man named Louis de Flores, who a remarkable individual, who among other things had become famous for inventing the cracking process for gasoline. And he ran this outfit which built simulators and training devices. And they're really some rather marvelous little things done with the technology of that day. One of the things they built, probably the most complex, was an airplane simulator, which used probably realistic cockpit from an existing airplane. And then this was backed up by a computer, which ran all the dials and knobs and switches and things of that sort, and enabled you to sit in this airplane and more or less fly it. The computer was made out of servos and thyrotrons and relays, and they were wonderful things. They'd click and whir and flash, and, you know, computers today are so dull, but they were really great in those days. They didn't work very well, but they sure made a fuss about it. Anyway, Cooley and others had the idea that instead of building a thing like this, which was then tuned up to look or feel like a real airplane, if they built one that solved the equations of motion and the aerodynamic equations of an airplane, and in a general sense, and then they set the parameters based on analysis or on wind tunnel tests, you could then make an airplane or an airplane simulation that felt like a real airplane which hadn't been built yet. And this would be a very powerful tool for airplane designing. Now, I've learned since from talking to aerodynamicists that there was a great deal of disbelief about this in the aerodynamics group and around the country. But it was an interesting time. You know, nowadays you probably couldn't get to do it because all these people would pop up and say it's terrible, and then there would be investigatory groups and studies and whatnot. But back in those days, nothing like that happened. DeFlorius thought it was a good idea, so he gave us some money. We thought it was a great idea, and we started to build it. As Ken said, it was originally intended to be an analog machine built with servos and ball disk integrators and all sorts of things. And it became obvious in short order that was a very difficult thing to do. The dynamic range required of the variables in order to really simulate the airplane over reasonable envelopes. Very difficult to get mechanically. But we built a lot of pieces, and we're working away at it, and a classmate of Jay's, Perry Crawford, who is now at IBM and was at that time at the Special Devices Center, introduced Jay to the electronic digital computer. And after a certain amount of thought, it became evident that that was a very new and interesting and powerful device, which looked like it would solve the problems that we were after and enable us to make a computer which had the flexibility, dynamic range, and so on that was needed. So we dropped the analog computer and started building the electronic digital computer. This was back in 1945. After a while, we became convinced that there were a lot of applications more important than the airplane stability control analyzer. There were changes in the Navy. Louis left, and the Navy lost interest in the simulator, and we never actually built it. But the computer survived and became Whirlwind. Now, I mentioned all this for a reason, to talk about the situation as it was back in 1946. The war was over, and there was a lot of interest in both the United States and Great Britain in electronic digital computers, and there were a number of groups. I don't remember how many, but there must have been upwards of half a dozen, mostly at universities, who were engaged in building electronic digital computers. This came for a number of reasons. There were some good new ideas, like stored programs. They were coming out primarily of the Moore School, von Neumann and Eckert and Walkley. There was the availability of technology in pulse circuits and in storage devices, which came out of the war, primarily that were developed for the use of the radar people. There were groups of capable and experienced people who were becoming available, who had, were used to building things during the war and were excited about that and wanted to continue to do so. Not least important, there were the mechanisms in place and funds in place for supporting things of this sort. In other words, there was a great opportunity, which a lot of people saw, but there were also the people and the resources and the technology and the momentum left over from the war that made it possible for all these groups to work on this digital computer. If today one would be forced to write a requirement and point out all the things it would do and how you were sure that you could do it and things of that sort, and it would make it very difficult. And things were different back in those days, and I think much more promising as far as developing new things are concerned. Most of these other people, however, as Ken said, were interested in a different kind of computing. Essentially all, not quite all, but essentially all the groups were driven by the need to solve some problem they had. Most of the problems came out of the universities, and they had to do with the solution of equations which describe natural phenomena of one sort and another. A lot of the demand was for the solution of partial differential equations. Some people just for investigatory or scientific purposes, other people to build things like nuclear weapons, other people to in the hopes of predicting the weather. There were all kinds of things of this sort. There were some people who were interested in business accounting, making out the payroll and things of that sort, that had grown out of the IBM equipment, punch card equipment, and so on, that was widely used for that purpose. The only group that I'm aware of anywhere that was interested in the machine and the possible use of an electronic digital computer for control purposes was our group. Now, after all, we'd spent the war working on control devices. This was the Servo Mechanisms Laboratory. We had a project to build a large simulator. And we were engineers. We came out of the engineering tradition. And we're used to engineering discipline, while the other groups were primarily led by scientists and mathematicians. I think the group at MIT had some other advantages as well. We were accustomed to large, complex projects. I speak now not myself so much as the MIT in general. During the war, to run the radiation laboratory and build a lot of interesting things. There were other laboratories. The general idea of building complicated things was not foreign to the group. We had, therefore, the understanding and backing of the MIT leadership, a very powerful force, especially with all of the reputation that the scientific and technical community had as it came out of the war. Another thing that we shouldn't forget is that as part of MIT, we had access to a steady flow of very capable people out of the graduate school. After the war, there were a lot of these people. In many cases, they had acquired degrees before the war, had gone into the war and served as radar or communications engineers, had gained a lot of experience about how the world worked, had come back out the other end and were going to graduate school and using the GI Bill. A lot of them were married. MIT had very strict rules, so there was a very highly select group that came to MIT. These people needed research assistantships. They needed to get attached to laboratories. We used to pay them as much as $150 a month. And we were very attractive because young people liked these things. They were electronicers. Here we were building this marvelous machine. We used to get the cream of the crop. It used to make the professors very mad at us. So that this was really a tremendous source of people. They came in and they went through the graduate school. We were able to keep a large fraction of the very good ones as permanent staff members. Ken and lots of other people came out of that. And they were a tremendous source of strength for the organization. Now, the result of all these things is that we were interested in a different kind of computing for a different kind of purpose. Real-time systems, like simulators, like control devices, have real-time things in them, like people. You can't turn the time scale of a person up and down. So if you had a system that involved both a person and a computer, the computer had to keep up. If it was unable to keep up, you couldn't just stop things for a while it did. It really had to keep up. And secondly, it had to be very reliable. Because if it broke down all the time in the middle of this test or this experiment, or worse still, of this when you're controlling something expensive and complicated, it'd be very unsatisfactory. As far as speeds are concerned, Whirlwind ran at about 0.04 MIPS. And that seems utterly trivial today, but it was a lot in 1950. Most of the machines these groups were working on were of the order of a few kips. Reliability was a special concern to us, too. Everybody was worried about reliability because, as Ken says, if you've got 10,000 tubes and they last 500 hours each, you're going to spend all your time fixing the machine. And there were many people who felt that you could never build an electronic digital computer out of vacuum tubes and get any useful work on it because you'd have to work on it all the time to keep it running. And the upshot is that everybody paid attention to reliability. But the people involved in non-real-time activities had a lesser demand on them. Because if you ran the program and it ran through, you've got the problem done, okay. And if it didn't, you could run it over again. And if you had a very long program, you could stop once in a while and store the intermediate results. And so the upshot was that if you sort of had a 50-50 chance of getting your problem done, and if the machine was available like half the time when you wanted it, you could use it. You wouldn't like it, you'd be annoyed at it, but you could use it. And so people were careful, but they were and concerned, but they had a more cavalier attitude toward it, relatively speaking, than we did. Because in our particular case, that was just unacceptable. The machine, in our opinion, had to run without failure for several hours, most of the time that you asked it to do that, you know, like better than 90%. That's for simulation and so on. For the actual control of important things, it had to do better than that. It liked today's special computers. It really should run all the time. Now, as an example of that, I'll say a little bit more about the Sage Direction Center, which was built in the mid-50s by us and many others. But the spec for that, and we wrote the spec, was that the center should not be down for more than 4 hours a year. That had 55,000 vacuum tubes in it, and the requirement was not down, run all the time, no unscheduled outage, more than 4 hours. It was done with a duplex machine, and it was done, as Ken says, with complete attention to reliability. Every decision put reliability first. Now, if you look at military electronics today, you'll find that a lot of it doesn't work very well. And a major reason that it doesn't work very well is that the people who design it do not put reliability first. It's not because they can't or they won't. It's their customer, the military, asks for performance first. In fact, the conversation usually takes the form of, I want this thing to be reliable. You got that? Okay, now let me tell you what I really want. The other kind of thing beside a computer that really works well is a satellite. And in my opinion, satellites really work well for the same reason that computers really work well, and that is people thought you couldn't build them at all, and that meant that the history and discipline of the thing was to put reliability first. And satellites put reliability first even more than computers do, because once you fired that thing, that's the last chance you get. The Sage Center, as I say, had a duplex computer. It was a sort of a poor man's Cirrus, if you can use the phrase poor man in regard to a Sage Center, which probably cost of the order of $250 million apiece in today's dollars. Anyway, those were the operating requirements on us, and it's why things were the way they were when Ken arrived. We really did pay attention to everything. There was a great deal of discipline, setting of standards, and setting of the way you tested things. For example, nobody was allowed to solder anything in the machine unless he had been through the soldering course. I never went through the soldering course, and I never was allowed to solder anything. I wouldn't have touched it under any circumstances anyway. I'll give you an example of the difference, one of the differences between our group and one of the other groups. The concern with computers was not so much permanent failures, because you can find permanent failures and fix them. The concern was with intermittence. And so if you have an intermittent in a solder joint, a cold solder joint, then you may have a problem. Our solution to that was to be very careful to wrap the leads around the pins, to solder them twice, to inspect them three times. This other group decided the way to do it was to lay the pin, the lead across another lead, and put a solder in between, and then put some tension on this, on the theory that if the joint started to go bad, it would pull open and then you could find it. Now, let me show you a few pictures of our machine. This is the Barta building, where we all worked back in the 40s and early 50s. It's the old Barta Press building down at MIT, right near the campus. It's still there and used for other purposes. I might say that one of the big advantages of this building is that it's over the railroad from MIT, and therefore did not fall under the purview of Buildings and Power. And we were able to keep the building clean ourselves and so on, and fix it and change it without having to go through the bureaucracy down at the Institute. That's another lesson we all got from... I don't know anything about the situation of digital equipment today, and I won't comment. The computer occupied about one-third of the top floor of this building, and eventually, with all the other things that were added to it, it occupied pretty close to half the building. As I said, we spent a great deal of time worrying about reliability, and vacuum tubes came first. Vacuum tubes fail for a number of reasons. One is a sort of infant mortality that you can get rid of by burning them in first for a while and then gets rid of the early ones. Secondly, they tend to sort of gradually deteriorate, and we found that one of the reasons was that the vacuum tube manufacturers put some things in the nickel of the cathode to make it easier to handle, and this would gradually grow an interface between the metal and the oxide coating, and so the thing, this was a resistance, and the tube would gradually deteriorate. And the other is mechanical problems that just resulted after all these tubes were poured off the line at about 30 cents a piece when we arrived. And the solution to this was to be very careful. The tubes were specially made for the laboratory. They cost the order of $10 a piece, which today would be about $100, which I think is of the order of a million times what a transistor costs on a chip these days. Anyway, we went to a lot of trouble to do that, and one of the things that we did was a thing called marginal checking. This was invented by Jay. The circuits were very carefully designed to have wide margins. And we found that if you properly selected the voltage, like the screen voltage or something of the sort, you could move the operating point within the margin and essentially measure the margin. So you could pick out gradually deteriorating components. In particular, you could pick out gradually deteriorating vacuum tubes. And this is a five-digit multiplier, which was an attempt to build a small piece of Whirlwind and to try it out and see what kind of reliability we were getting and what kind of how the marginal checking worked. It multiplied 2 5-bit numbers together and checked the answer. And the young fellow in the saddle shoes is with us today. That's Norm Taylor sitting back here. You're not wearing your saddle shoes today, though. Anyway, this worked very well. In fact, at one stage of the game, it worked for 40 days without making a mistake. As an example of the way people look at things, There were only a few groups. You could get all the people working on computers in the world together in one room if you wanted to, and very often did. And people came around and visited each other all the time. They disagreed with each other on almost every subject, but they came and talked to each other. And Aiken came to see us, and Jay showed him the five-digit multiplier. Wow. This is Howard Aiken at Harvard.
I ran a 3-megacycle. I was very proud of that.
Yes. Anyway, so Jay took Howard in and showed him this thing and showed him how it worked 40 days. And Aiken, I don't know how many of you know Aiken, but he was a big, impressive-looking fellow. He shakes his head. And on the way out, he says, well, he says, 5 bits, that's about 1 decimal digit, he said. He said, trouble goes as the square of the word length. 10 decimal digits, pretty good word, so that's a factor of 100, so that's about a half a day. He says, that's not bad, and off he goes. But 40 days was good. This shows you how the tubes came out, finally. There were, at the time this measurement was made in 1950, there were 3,500 tubes in this record keeping, and we took very detailed records. This is the number of failures. There was about 2,500 hours. So there's about 10 million tube hours or something in this list, and there were 18 failures not due to tube characteristics that were not found by marginal checking. So that's 18 out of 10 million hours. That's a lot better than 500 hours, and that's the kind of numbers you need in order to do what we're trying to do. Another thing that happened was that Ken mentioned how we used to connect things right to the scopes, I'm eternally impressed by, as I wander around the laboratories, the beautiful instrumentation we have these days. We didn't have that in the early days. We had to build most of the stuff we wanted. This is a test facility. I think that's a, if memory serves me, that's a diode switch on the top. And one of the things we found out is that there was hardly anybody working on the computer. Everybody was working on the test equipment. And this led to a decision to build a bunch of standardized test equipment, standard building blocks, the things that were mentioned earlier, that you could plug together and get any pulse train you wanted, and gates and things of that sort. And this was done and built in large quantities and made available to people. So if you wanted to put together a test set, you could get most of what you needed out of the stock room instead of starting over. This is a typical element. I think that's a pulse generator. Eventually, Ken built a series of these things made out of transistors, which we used. And then I think, if I understand correctly, that was your first product at Digital. And people build a lot of things out of these. You know, you couldn't just build test facilities. People built whole computers out of them on occasion. The machine was spread out in two dimensions so that you could add every piece of it. This is one digit of the accumulator. It contains two flip-flops and a number of gates. And it's about this wide, about this high. So we were very careful about putting a flip-flop in the machine. As Ken said, we went to a lot of trouble to design the circuits properly, to have standard circuits, to have standard pulses, to have standard connections, so that you could plug things together with reasonable confidence it would work. And then the logical structure, Ken says that we treated it like a puzzle, but I thought we treated it like an engineer would. It was like designing a bridge or something.